Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Randomly Generated History
Happy
Club.
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year to you all.
We made it.
We made it to the year 2024.
2024, yes. Time traveler will.
Right.
Here's the thing. We told Will to ad lib and say something along the lines of like Happy New Year, and we've now reached the limit of his ad lib.
We did say New Year, New Me. Okay, so this week we are doing the year 1952, and therefore we're going to need some three letter words.
Three words. I need people. To edit mine.
Three words from people. I'll go first.
Okay.
I'm Ivy Mike.
I'm Ivy Mike.
Yep.
Interesting. Ivy Mike.
Hi.
I'm Anna, by the way. We didn't do that part.
Oh, yeah,
names.
Sorry. Yeah, Will, and...
Jesus.
New year, new me.
New year, same podcast. Will, what are your words?
Hi, my name's Will, everyone.
Hi,
also.
That's too many words.
My three words are...
Mm-hmm.
The sound of silence.
The sound of silence.
Sound of silence.
Sound of silence. Sound
the
of silence.
Sound of.
Sound of silence.
Sound okay. of silence.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. My three words I forgot to do, so I'm just going to say burn, baby, burn.
Nice.
Burn, baby, burn.
Yeah.
Okay, good. That could be anything.
Good.
Great.
Starting as we mean to go on for 2024.
Here we go, 1952. Extreme professionals.
So today, I'm going to talk about the American composer, John Cage. And his most famous...
Brother
Nicholas Cage. Who, of course, is, I think now, officially the world's greatest ever actor. Is that right? He got
that
award?
Yes, that is true. That is true.
So I'm going to talk about his most famous and controversial piece, John Cage's, not Nicholas Cage's.
Face Off.
And such a good film. And this piece is called 4 Minutes 33 Seconds and was first performed in the year 1952, which I hope is the year we're doing this.
That
week.
Is, yes. Yeah, it is. The well year. Done.
Right. I think I know this.
So a bit of John Cage, first of all. So he was quite a remarkable guy. He was a composer. He was a music theorist, an artist, a philosopher, and he was quite widely recognized for having a really innovative avant-garde approach to music.
So he was
born on September 5th, 1912 in Los Angeles, and he's his career is pretty broad, as I've said, but he was particularly noted for non-traditional sounds in his music. Like, for instance, startling a squirrel and oh. and recording the sound a startled squirrel makes.
That's my ringtone.
That is a good sonic ambience there from squirrels, yes.
Yeah. Or listening to a hedgehog snoring.
Oh, beautiful.
And other types of music.
You know who he would have loved? That guy who is obsessed with glands, who liked making weird music stuff.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
From the Hedy Lamarr, yeah.
He'd love a theremin. Was theremins around then?
Oh, I think so.
I think it's one of the ugliest instruments, by the way.
I think they sound really cool.
Is this the kind of laser? No, what's the? How does it work again?
You move your
electromagnetic. Like Star Trek, like.
It's like a two antenna kind of thing, and you move your hand, and it interprets your position of your hand in the electromagnetic spectrum and makes a sound that sounds like garbage.
I bet he had five of them.
Yes.
Yeah. Invented in 1928, so we're good.
It could be determined.
So his most famous piece is what I'm going to talk about today, and it's also his most controversial. Can you guess, or do you know why?
Well,
I think I do know this.
I mean, I am going to... I think I can intuit it from your three-word preview with Sound of Silence. Yeah. So I think his most controversial piece was a very bad cover version of a Simon and Garfunkel song that was 15 years before the song was released to the public. Am I right?
You are correct. So it consists of... This is the track, if you can call it such a thing, mm-hmm. 4:33. It consists of a pianist coming to a piano and not striking any keys for the duration of the piece, which is to say it consists of nothing at all.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And there are three movements to the tune, and the total length, of course, is 4:33. But contrary to some misconceptions by some cynical types out there, it is not simply supposed to be 4:33 of silence. It actually isn't supposed to be the sound of silence. So it's supposed to be a challenge to kind of like the audience's perception of what music is.
Okay. Yeah.
And like the sound of the actual kind of like quote music unquote.
Yeah, yeah. So my perception of music is that it contains some music.
Yeah. yeah. Yes. I mean, I wasn't ready to be challenged
pretty
solid in my conception of music.
So there's a genre of music called noisecore, which is exactly as it sounds. It's just noise, and they take like all these electronic equipment pieces and just like push it to breaking point, and it's just disgusting. But I would say that's more musical than nothing, I think. Maybe it's not.
Well,
God, he's got me thinking.
Or is it?
Yeah, good question, John Cage.
So the piece is actually supposed to be, or the music in the piece is supposed to be the ambient sounds within the environment in which you're listening to the music.
Okay. Now, did the pianist move his fingers over the keys and just not strike them? Or did he literally come out, sit on the bench and do nothing?
He sits at the bench. He does nothing.
Okay.
That's incredible. Imagine that gig. You're a pianist. You've trained for years. You've gone to Juilliard.
Yeah.
You've been in Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
You've done all the birthday parties.
Yeah.
And suddenly you get this gig and you're like, oh, what's my fee? I don't know. How much does a pianist get paid?
$70 billion.
$70 billion.
Dollars.
And,
exactly
and,
right.
And you just sit there and do nothing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Maybe. I could do that.
You could. You absolutely could.
If anyone's hiring pianists, please let me know.
Specifically for cover versions of 4:33.
So the philosophy of the guy is that it's kind of influenced by his obsession with Zen Buddhism.
Okay.
And there's this idea that in any environment, there are sounds that could be considered musical and could constitute music. And it's like challenging what is actually supposed to, you know, what actually is the focus of your attention, you know, during it, what frames musical sound and all this kind of thing. Anyway, it's obviously a load of bollocks. But the, so it specifically, he was interested in these ideas of like these quote white paintings, unquote, by this artist called Robert Rauschenberg, who appeared, which appeared to be blank white spaces.
Yeah.
And were. So that's what it's all about. Is like what constitutes accidental sound and accidental music. And his piece is often viewed as a sort of form of meditation, inviting listeners to experience the sound of their environment in a new way.
Amazing.
So I'm on the Wikipedia page for it right now, and there is you can play the song.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great recording.
I've been playing it this whole time.
No, we can't. The copyright infringes. Don't play that.
Oh.
We get a copyright strike.
Okay, I'll stop. I'll stop. But I mean, just listen to it. It's really beautiful.
Sorry, I'm ruining it.
No, I'm taking in the ambient noise of your laughter, which is like music to me.
There's other artists as well that have covered it, by the way. So Moby famously covered it.
I just love this. I'm going to cover
and
it.
Also Depeche Mode also covered
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that tracks.
And there was another artist, I can't remember who it was. I want to say it was Korn or something. And they did a song that was 1 minute of silence. And they said, hey, this is extremely derivative. And they said, yeah, well, what it took John Cage 4 minutes and 33 seconds to say, we said in 1 minute. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, I think it was Korn, I'm not sure.
That's deeply profound.
It's amazing.
This is why they hate us.
So he's continued to have, throughout the rest of his career, he continued to have like quite a big influence on the boundaries of music and sound, and using different ways to use non-standard instruments to try and create music. But like they weren't all just
left-handed flute.
Left-handed flute.
Yep. Amazing. Non-standard.
Very non-standard. And
forward-facing flute.
Forward-facing flute. Yeah. It's really hard to.
And in fact, a left-handed flute, of course, also an act of blasphemy.
Yeah, it's not allowed in Orthodox churches. Yeah.
So throughout his career, he's had this sort of continued. He died in 1992, but he had this like continued impact on musicians in this kind of part of the music industry. So like he was interested in exploring non-standard instruments exploring like different ways of creating sound and music, and he's still in that world considered super influential. And so it's not just the silence thing that he did.
John Cage.
And so recently, actually, I remember a few years back there was some sort of like 50th edition or 50th year edition or something where there was a 5 CD special release album containing this track plus others in this oeuvre, which included things like the hum of a electrical socket, and I don't know, someone like crying silently, or all this kind of just garbage. But it was a special edition, so you can get that on eBay if you want to.
I mean, it's just the absolute rock bottom of the artist, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I'll go a pretty long way towards defending art, but there are some things that really just grate my cheese.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same with if you install an artwork and it's just a white square.
Yeah,
that isn't.
Yeah,
I mean, there's,
you're having a laugh.
You can do lots of mental gymnastics, observing something like that, but it's just not very impressive.
The best thing is like the placard, which is like, this is a deep meditation
on the
run up to the Franco-Prussian War, and it's like, fuck off! It is like it's just a white canvas.
So not to be the hippie in the room, I'm going to say that if I went into an art museum and I saw a blank canvas, I would argue that's better than most of the things there. Because is it really art if it's not pictures of fruit, a horse, or a ship?
I was going to say, what is what's the Jack Donaghy quote about art? Like, we know what art is. It's paintings of horses.
Pretty much.
Yeah, the only three appropriate subjects for a painting are horses, ships with sails, and men staring off into the distance while holding swords.
I think that's pretty close, yeah.
Yeah.
Don't disagree. There you have it, John Cage and his 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence.
Who's next?
I was giving a reverent 4 minute and 33 silent
I'll
break.
Leave that in there. Yeah. I'll leave that in there as a little reprieve. I'm next. It's me. I'm Ivy Mike. So today we're revisiting November 1952 to explore the world's first hydrogen bomb test.
Ooh.
Codenamed Ivy Mike.
Ivy like the plant or Ivy like an
Ivy?
Ivy, okay.
Ivy Mike. So this is obviously a very significant escalation in nuclear capabilities. Up until now, we had only the A-bombs, atomic bombs, silly, pithy, stupid little toys, spud guns, and now we have the massive, impressive H-bombs instead, much more powerful. Also, lots of political tension at this time in the 50s.
Mm.
So let's go back. Let's talk about the scientific breakthrough, the Cold War anxieties, and the dynamic cultural shifts.
Mm.
So as we look back at the 50s, it's important to grasp the kind of zeitgeist of the era. So obviously there was this tension and transition of powers, but in popular culture, for example, we had the very famous Johnny Ray's Cry was topping the Billboard charts, captivating the emotive spirit of the time.
Can you sing us a couple of bars of
that? I can absolutely do that, but I'm going to just read you this very cheery tune that was capturing the zeitgeist. If your sweetheart sends a letter of goodbye, it's no secret, you'll feel better if you cry.
Oh, I love that. You know, that's a real takedown of toxic masculinity 70 years before that became a thing.
It goes on in that vein. If your heartache seems to hang around too long and your blues keep getting bluer with each song, remember sunshine can be found behind the cloudy sky. So let your hair down and go on and cry.
If you think that the A-bomb was weak... and it is a bigger destruction you seek, go ahead and cry away.
Plutonium will save you.
And today. The day.
Anyway, also on the silver screen at the time, which won the Oscar for the Best Picture, was The Greatest Show on Earth, which was, quote, a dazzling spectacle of life behind the scenes with the Ringling Bros, Barnum and Bailey Circus, which is the best three-ring circus on land. So it's a film about a circus, which sounds like a great show. Anyway, also, Hollywood was in its golden era or silver era, it depends on which era.
Bronze era.
It was they were using bronze tools.
they graduated from stone and Humphrey flint
Bogart,
tools.
Katharine Hepburn, they were setting the standards with their chisels.
It makes me really nervous when he does a preamble like this.
Yeah. No, it's not at all. Ernest Hemingway. Also, The Old Man and the Sea was published, which won him the Nobel Prize this year, and it's a great book.
In 1952?
I think it's 1952. It's not.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, setting the world stage, Eisenhower was president, Churchill was back in power again at the stage, he's about to get kicked out, and Stalin was still ensconced just about at this time. He dies the next year, and then Russians' favourite thing would happen, which is a vodka-fueled three-way, or... Troika, which is three rulers at the same time.
Wow.
This is an immense amount of context.
The 50s was dense.
Okay. So you say Stalin was ensconed?
Ensconced.
Stalin was ensconed in a lovely maple glaze.
He's having afternoon tea.
Wow. Yeah, biscuit.
I had no idea that happened to him.
But ultimately, this is all to say that the US and Russia were pitched in this desperate ideological war, this charged atmosphere. And deeply entrenched mutual sort of hatred of each other meant that this spurred the race for nuclear supremacy. It's not just a matter of scientific achievement, but this critical aspect of national defense and global dominance. Who could build a better bomb, etc.
The old man or the sea, which was America.
Is America the fish?
I think America is the fish. Yeah, exactly. I think Russia is like not in the book.
America, like, it spoiler alert. It ends up a skeleton, like dead on the boat, but technically didn't lose.
Yeah, exactly. USA.
So the Ivy Mike test was the brainchild of some of the most brilliant minds, obviously, at the time. Edward Teller, often called the father of the hydrogen bomb, was a figure of controversy and acclaim. Obviously, you know, it's a double-edged bomb that has been made.
What are the two edges of the bomb?
Yeah, good edge, bad edge.
So his vision for the bomb was obviously far more powerful than the A-bomb that was dropped in Japan, and he kind of propelled this project forward, this vision. And he had a team of gifted physicists, engineers, and experts all working in this utmost secrecy. You know, is really, really tightly controlled. You've seen Oppenheimer, think that kind of level, but yeah, less Hollywood, more real. It's kind of hilarious, actually, given how tremendously easy it is to actually make a H-bomb. It's so easy, I'm actually going to actually tell you how to do it.
Oh, boy.
So, first of all, you kind of need basically like a big bucket, I guess.
Okay.
Like a big bucket, not like, you know, those thin ones you get in like B&Q that are transparent and they break the whole time. You want to get like a real thick one, like a horse bucket. You know, horses, they tend to have that thickest bucket.
Yeah, I have a horse bucket.
My horse has a bucket.
My horse bucket has a bucket.
And then you just need like a run-of-the-mill standard, just, you know, basic fission primary stage.
Sure.
Yeah.
My horse has that as well, weirdly.
White label's fine, but you should push for a brand one if you can get it.
Okay.
But that is, of course, consisting of uranium-238, tritium, more uranium, and a vacuum.
Like a Hoover?
I don't know.
Can Henry the Hoover work?
Wikipedia was not very clear on this.
Okay.
So bung that all in the bucket, stick in a bit of polystyrene foam, apparently.
Yep.
For radiation channeling. and then a bit of pinch of uranium and a tamper or something,
yeah.
And then some octane 95 fusion fuel, which is, of course, lithium 6 dioxide or deuteride.
I'm
and
really close to having all of the required ingredients.
Really? I don't know. Why did it take them so long?
I know. I'm incredible. Little short on tritium.
When you grew up in, Canada, I'm going to say?
Yeah. It's pronounced Kansas.
Sorry, Kansas. Canada.
Kansas stuff.
Did they have Blue Peter there? And are you aware of Blue Peter?
I am only aware of Blue Peter because there is an epidemic among men of my age on their dating 21, thank you, on their dating profiles saying that they have a Blue Peter badge. I just kept seeing this and I was like, what does that mean?
Is there really?
Yeah.
Did you put this on their profile?
Yeah.
Amazing.
And I looked it up and you all should be very proud of yourselves.
Do you want to explain what it is for our American
Yeah.
And do they have us in Ireland, by the way, as well?
No, not at all. No. Oh, we've got a different culture.
So Blue Peter, I think it's still running. It's a British children's TV program that's been running, if it's still running, which it probably is, for, I don't know, like 70 or 80 years now, continuously. And it is what do you call a show where they do inane things all the time, like the One Show,
like a kids show, or kind of like a just a, I don't know, like a
like this kind of show that's on at like 5 p.m. in the evening in the UK for adults, and they just have different segments on random stuff.
Wait, but it's a kids show, or
but it's aimed at kids.
It's aimed at kids.
And this used to be on at like 4:30 in the afternoon. Yeah, it was probably once
along
the same time.
You come home from school, you watch. Yeah,
and anyway, one of the things they used to have a garden, and they used to always have a dog, and the dog, and they always used to go and go and interview children doing interesting things across the country.
Okay. The dog would
interview children doing interesting things. But one of the things they always used to do was they had like a make it yourself at home segment, which is a repeated segment.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. I was wondering how the H-bomb comes in.
Yeah.
Something they would always used to do is blow up the dog with an H-bomb.
and of my generation, the most famous and like virally successful and popular thing they did was a version of Tracy Island, like Thunderbirds.
Yeah, okay.
The Thunderbirds Island.
I'm lost.
Do you know Thunderbirds?
Thunderbirds is another British institution.
Oh my God, this is like...
this is hilarious, this.
I had no idea how deep this is in British culture.
Yeah.
So Thunderbirds is a puppeteering show for kids. Where puppets were like spies.
Yeah.
They were secret spies and they had gadgets and they had like special craft. Like, and the Thunderbird 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And they had like Thunderbirds are go. Like, countdown.
One was so Thunderbird 1 was a spaceship. No,
we don't need to go into this.
Yeah, okay.
Thunderbirds were like kids, but they were puppets.
Yeah.
And they had American accents.
Blue Peter made a Thunderbird.
Blue Peter taught a generation of school children how to create an incredibly complex. international spy station in their homes over the course of a summer, and everyone used to send away for the packs. I think we could do a similar thing for a fusion bomb.
Yeah, we definitely could. The first issue is 99 cents, and then the next one is 4.5 trillion.
You know, right before we started recording, when we were talking about our New Year's resolutions for the podcast,
yes.
Branching into merch was one of them.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And, T-shirts, hats, all that nonsense. But really, if we did a randomly generated history club branded... fusion bomb kit.
Yes.
That would be so successful.
It would fly off the shelves.
It really would.
Yeah.
And I think global
instability...
Sorry,
they won't fly because the ballistics is actually very complicated. That'll be next year.
Okay. Yeah, we'll probably have to do a collab with Raytheon for the
hypersonic missile. Yeah.
Yeah.
And global instability is only rising. So what could be safer than... total mutual assured destruction, not just between nation states, but between every individual.
Yeah.
You know, everyone is mutually deterring everyone.
Yeah, the only way to deter a bad guy with a bomb is a good guy with a bomb.
Is everyone with a bomb.
We should have a bomb in every school.
Oh my God.
Oh, Jesus.
Sorry, carry on.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I've completely lost the run of this. Anyway, the chosen site for this historic test was Enewetak Atoll, which is a remote location in the Pacific Ocean, which is actually about 40 coral atolls in a circle, and from space it kind of looks like a sandy ringworm. But it's very pretty, actually, in spite of that. But it's no higher than 5 meters off the sea, so quite a low, you know, scrap of nothing. And it's one of the most western atolls in the whole thing, you know, the Bikini Atoll, you might have heard as well, the Bikini Island tests and stuff there. So the preparation for the test was undertaken. It was really complex and, you know, lots of precision engineering and stuff. The device, they built a massive structure, which was like anything, unlike anything previously built, in order to house the detonation chamber.
And sorry, when you say unlike anything previously built, it was just, I mean, there's like a 18-story dock or something.
It was like... It was
I mean, arguably, that's pretty similar to the Trojan horse, so that's not even... It doesn't even fit the brief.
It combined an extremely complex, intricate engineering and logistical challenges going across all that way, so they had to build these crazy...
It was a duck.
Yeah, it was a big duck. Big, big, big wooden duck. But they also built what was called the Runit Dome, R-U-N-I-T Dome, which was to store the radioactive soil and debris post-test. Good news... Due to the shoddy workmanship of the 50s and poor understandings of basic safety, the dome is eroding and could be breached by a typhoon any day, unleashing radioactive material.
Really?
Atoll, yes.
Cool. Well, so they came in later and built this dome over the top of Ground Zero?
No, they built the dome purpose to run it as a little bit, is in a different atoll nearby that they built to house it, and the idea was to ship it there.
Oh, I see.
But even better news, we're actually not going to suffer from that because the contents of the lagoon that's contained within this circular atoll is actually more radioactive than anything that it contains in this Runit dome.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, whatever. No point spending money on that. Also, there's huge subsistence happening in that place. And one of the areas that used to be above surface is now 1,400 meters below the surface. So, like...
1,400 meters below.
Yeah, it's not due to like anything other than like just
volcanic,
just subsistence, like basically. Oh, okay. Yeah, just subsistence, and it just goes to show like choose your places where you want to test bombs really carefully.
Yeah.
And don't build wooden ducks there, I guess. Anyway, as the test date approached, the world was totally unaware of what was about to unfold, and some people were quite optimistic about the future returning to a more stable status quo of peacetime and cooperation. For example, the Helsinki Olympics had just concluded a few months earlier, where US won 76 medals and USSR won 71.
Ha, suck it.
Well, that kind of attitude is going to spur the Cold War on for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's sort of there's a bit of hopefulness in, and then obviously kaboom, that went up. But speaking of Helsinki Olympics... I've got a couple of quiz questions for you.
Okay.
The 100-meter dash in the men's, what time was it done in?
In 1954?
1952.
Probably like 15 or 16 seconds. Mm-hmm. Because now it's about 9 or 10, right?
It's like 9 and 0.5 or something. Yeah. Now. Yeah. I reckon I'm going to say... I'll say 14 seconds.
6 minutes and 32 seconds with a cigarette break. No, it was...
Oh my God, I was like, hang on. Even I could run 100 blase. Meters in 6 minutes.
So I actually thought, like you, that it would be very, very, very slow or something. It'd be crazy. But actually, no, it was 10 seconds and 10.4 seconds.
Wow.
So
okay.
Actually still okay. Quite fast. Like cool. Still pretty, pretty rapid.
But
actually.
Humans have still improved that a lot.
Oh, they have. Meantime. They have. But it's not like I thought it'd be a lethargic, like little brisk jog with people with like, you know, tight shorts and like curled, curled mustaches or whatever. Anyway, for bonus points, this is for all the ducks. Can you name the top three countries at dressage this year?
This in 1952?
Yeah. Hang on, sorry. Can I just... I sometimes don't always pay close attention.
Yeah.
But
oh no, we're way off the rails.
We're talking about 1952, and dressage happened in the Olympics, and there's three countries that came gold, silver, and bronze, and I'm
but you were talking about the hydrogen bomb.
Yeah, I know, but this is all related.
But remember, he also talked about the old man in the sea. He talked about that song about
I
crying.
I am highlighting the juxtaposition between the peaceful horse dancing event and the big bomb that's about to go off.
Historically,
anyway.
Historically, the countries that are the best at equestrian events, mm-hmm. of which dressage is one,
yes.
would be the UK or yeah. Great Britain. Is that the Olympic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great Britain. The Netherlands.
Yeah.
France?
I would say, yeah, like Belgium, Luxembourg.
You're right, but it is Sweden, Denmark, and France this year.
Sweden
kind of swept all the horsey events, except for jumping, bizarrely, this year.
Yeah, interesting.
Which England did very
well. That's because their horses would have been less jet-lagged, because they only had to get to Helsinki.
True. That is very true. That is true. Yeah. Anyway, 1952, November 1st, Ivy Mike was detonated, and it sent this shockwave, literally and figuratively, of awe, fear, and nuclear debris. The mushroom cloud, which is the largest that's ever been seen up until that point, rose over 100,000 feet into the Pacific air, or approximately 50,000 two-foot snakes, which was a stark reminder of the new power humanity had unlocked. And this
50,000 two-foot snakes is a terrifying power.
Terrifying.
And how are they? They're all balancing. They're all organized themselves.
Yeah.
Well, they had to like string them, I guess. And the long floss, and they just made them eat something, I guess. And it, you know, kind of whatever. Anyway, this test ushered in the age of thermonuclear weapons, which is a period defined by its potential for unparalleled destruction up until this point.
And an age we've been enjoying ever since.
Ever since, we've been basking in the warm thermonuclear glow.
I prefer to think of it as the age of Swedish dressage supremacy.
So soon after this, Queen Elizabeth was coronated. So this is setting the time. You know, the legacy of Ivy Mike is quite complex, I guess you can say. It's obviously a remarkable scientific achievement, but it was also an escalation in the arms race and more proliferation of more powerful weapons, etc. And so overall, complex. But in summary, 1950s was this great time of innovation. 1952 was this landmark event that's probably going to stand out in the annals of history as a significant event, not least of all for great music and films about circuses, but also for H-bombs.
I really didn't know how you were going to land this plane.
And we did, and
I'm still not quite convinced you've done it.
Everyone survived. Please disembark.
Okay. Well, I was going to talk about the Swedish winning dressage at the 1952 Olympics, so let me just rejigger real quickly. No, as Ant said... 1952, pretty pivotal year. He mentioned that that's the year Queen Elizabeth took the throne, and it's also pretty pivotal in terms of the decline of the British Empire.
No.
Yes, which I know you refuse to recognize. So, Will, I'm going to tell a fictional story for your entertainment.
No, I just don't agree with the framing of decline. I just think this is a blip.
Oh.
Yeah, it's just.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Yeah, the sun shall set again.
It's a good time to invest. Buy low.
Yeah.
Also, just point, Queen Elizabeth was in 53. So
that's right.
Summer 53.
The king died in 52, and she was coronated
so don't
in 53.
At me, okay?
Yeah, fair enough. Good correction.
Queen, king.
And The Old Man and the Sea was released in 52, won the Pulitzer in 53, won the Nobel in 54.
But captured her hearts ever since.
Yeah, exactly. Terrible book. Okay.
Do you not like it?
Hemingway is not my favorite.
Interesting.
I recognize the craft.
The style is not your favorite?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that it's short.
Not for everyone.
Yeah, it's true. It's
famously
it's
short.
Brisk.
Not just the overall length, but even the sentences.
Yeah.
Short.
Yeah, it's very pithy.
Yeah. I get it, but I don't like it.
Fair. Okay.
Good. First edition of our book club complete. Let us know what you think in the comments.
Right.
Hang on, do we have comments?
In the podcast comments.
In the podcast comments.
Yeah, leave us a review where you talk about how you like Old
actually,
Man in the Sea.
You know what? If you join our Patreon, this is actually true. Usually we don't plug Patreon until the end. But if you join our Patreon, there's now like a community chat room thing. We can all discuss the books.
Oh my God, I would love that.
Yeah,
that's
it exists.
I'm dying to hear from
this could be the first
listeners.
Topic.
Really? Okay, great.
Okay, great.
So Old Man in the Sea. Good, bad, great. Anyway, British Empire is about to go into its blip, by which I mean it's falling apart. There's Kenya's not going well in 1952, but I'm going to focus on Egypt. So the British occupied Egypt starting in 1882, and then in 1922 they recognized Egypt's independence, but they were still the de facto rulers of the whole place. It's like a puppet monarchy, basically. And for the British, it was essential that they remained in control of the Suez Canal.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Which is famously a great place for boats to get stuck. And so after World War II, the British occupation zone was basically just the canal, but they were still kind of running the show. But there started to be some real Egyptian nationalist and revolutionary movements, and they wanted the British out. Many of these were led by guerrilla groups called Fedayeen, who would attack British forces in Egypt using irregular warfare tactics like sabotage and raids.
Crab walking.
They loved a crab walk, which, you know.
It's pretty irregular.
It's very irregular. You see a bunch of dudes coming at you crab walking, you don't think, like, I'm about to get attacked.
Yeah, no, they're going to attack someone 90 degrees
yeah, that exactly. way. Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like, wow, what an interesting modern dance. So, crab walking, exactly. The government of Egypt were completely thrown by the crab walkers, and King Farouk I did not support them, but they were hugely popular with the people. And in late 1951 and early 1952, the British military carried out numerous anti-Fedayeen operations in the canal zone, including several in the city of Ismailia, which was under British control. And in January 1952, Fedayeen forces killed two British soldiers and a nun, which is, you know, just feels harsh.
It's and, a little harsh.
Yeah. It's all harsh, yeah. But it's, you know, a nun? Why a nun?
In their defense, if you weren't used to seeing nuns, and then suddenly there was one in a battlefield, you'd focus attention on that nun.
Yeah.
That looks like the Sith leader.
That's true. They do have an interesting headpiece. Anyway, so on the 25th of January, the British retaliated. And the British had a force of 7,000 soldiers and 6 tanks, which they used to surround a building.
Those are really packed tanks.
That had... Yeah, they were really crammed in there. And they surrounded a building full of Egyptian auxiliary policemen who were sheltering some of the Fedayeen in the building. So 7,000 British soldiers and about 700 or 800 Egyptian policemen. So pretty fair fight.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, if you find yourself in a fair fight, militarily speaking, you've done bad palling.
Yeah.
It should never be fair.
No, that's like safe ratio. I would
safe
say.
Ratio, yeah. 10 to 1.
Yeah.
Well, the Egyptians held out for about 2 hours, which is, you know, against
laudable.
a lot of tanks. Is something. Eventually, they ran out of ammo and the British captured the building. And there were some casualties on both sides, a few more on the Egyptian side. But the next morning, the 26th of Jan, the news of this standoff had spread throughout Egypt and Egyptians started to take to the streets in Cairo. At some point in the afternoon, a large fire broke out and it swept incredibly quickly throughout downtown Cairo. And the focus of the fire, as I read that, can a fire have a focus?
The epicenter?
Yeah.
Starting point?
Yeah. The fires Fulcrum? Were concentrated on British-owned businesses.
Fish and chip shops.
Yeah, fish and chip shops.
Jelly deal shops. Boot polish.
You couldn't find a jellied eel in Cairo after this day.
That JD Sports.
JD Sports, yeah.
B&Q.
Greg's.
Oh my God. Yeah, you couldn't
nothing worse than a burnt Greg's.
For a sausage roll fire. The first thing that people burned was the Casino Opera Entertainment Club, which you performed at, didn't you?
I have, yeah. I had a residency there for 4 years. Yeah. 4 successive summers.
Yeah.
That's right.
It was, you were on the forward-facing flute.
Yeah, forward-facing flute? Yeah, I was on the forward-facing flute and then, frankly, an old-fashioned crooner.
Display.
Yeah, yeah.
Crooning. Good.
Well, they didn't like your show, so they burned down your club. Hotels, the automobile club, a Barclays bank, movie theaters, nightclubs. The arsonists also focus on venues that the king frequented, which is great. So he went to a lot of nightclubs and restaurants.
Getting 5 Jaeger bombs for a tenner or something.
Hang on, how
King Farouk loved happy hour.
Oh, I see. King Farouk, not King George.
Not King George. No, King Farouk.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to make a point about how frequently do you have to go to a place to frequent it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Was he just on the table shouting at Mr. Brightside?
Yeah. Who was, and at that point, King George would have been like quite ill, right?
Yes, I would have thought.
From all the partying, obviously.
Yeah. So there was a ton of looting and theft, as happens in these things, and a curious absence of the Egyptian army. The fire started in the early afternoon, but the army didn't arrive until sunset, when most of the damage was already done.
I see.
Curious. The fire eventually became known as Black Saturday. About 300 shops were destroyed at a cost of £3.4 million of damage.
That is a lot.
And I was like reading about the types of shops that were destroyed, and there's some numbers here, which makes it sound like Cairo was a really cool place to be. So it was like 13 hotels, 40 movie theaters,
wow,
73 coffee houses, 92 bars, 16 social clubs, and 10 firearms shops.
Wow.
So it's just like wild.
That's a pretty
cool.
Yeah.
And
they all got burnt.
They all got burnt.
Wowee.
Yeah, 300 shops. And 26 people died, which was also seen as sort of curiously low, given how widespread the destruction was.
Yeah.
So because of the combination of these things, there are obviously some conspiracy theories at play here
100%.
About who started the fires and what the point was.
Maybe some insurance things. It's probably a combination of all these things.
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems clear that there were some organized elements at play. This wasn't just spontaneous arson. I mean, the fact that exclusively British businesses and Western businesses were targeted. There was a real speed and precision to how the fires were started. They had tools to force open closed doors. They used acetylene stoves to melt steel barriers on windows.
Acetylene torches don't melt steel barriers.
Well, apparently they do in 1952. They used cars to execute the plan quickly. They chose Saturday afternoon for the attack because offices and stores were closed on the weekends and the movie theaters would be in the post-matinee, pre-evening show.
Oh, lull. Yeah.
So people knew what they were doing, but who were they?
Mole.
Soviet Union.
Moles.
Soviet Union. Moles.
I think they're communist moles.
Or like inside.
Communist ground dwelling rodents.
Subterranean mammals.
I won't specify which animal.
Okay,
it is,
but great. But yeah. Just moles.
Yeah.
Soviets are not typically cited as possible perpetrators. They kind of hadn't gotten involved in Egypt yet. They would soon after. Some people believe that King Farouk masterminded the whole thing to get rid of his prime minister, who he didn't like and whose policies were more sympathetic to the revolutionary element. Some implicated the Muslim Brotherhood or the Egyptian Socialist Party. And of course, some people believe the British were behind it all to punish the Egyptian prime minister for unilaterally repealing the Anglo-Egyptian alliance treaty. And there were many investigations, but no culprits were ever found or charged, so the whole thing remains a bit shrouded in mystery. But in the aftermath, the king, Farouk, was more unpopular than ever, and there was a group of officers who had already been planning to launch a coup against him, but the fire convinced them to actually bring forward that date. And in July 1952, two guys you've probably heard of, Mohammed Naguib and Gamal Abdel Nasser, led the successful coup to depose King Farouk and launch the Egyptian Revolution. So there you go.
That's crazy. I didn't know that. That's so many fires.
A lot of fires. Big Black Saturday. Big fire.
But like, I guess it didn't suit the king in the end, really, did it?
Yeah, no. He really saw the writing on the wall, and there was just this huge wave of support for a democratic government and the end of the monarchy.
I blame the communist rodents.
You always do.
For sure.
Thank you for joining us. That's everything you would ever need to know about the year 1952.
Yes, and if you heard any drilling, that was the sound of the communist rodents had just started right on cue.
Someone has given them power tools.
I'll try and
terrifying.
Edit it out of post, but I can't guarantee you. So if it's not there and I said all this, just imagine a really annoying humming noise.
Like a
Anyway. Yes, all that's left to do is boot up the random number generator. But as this is a new year, your New Year's resolution could be, should be, and I would argue legally must be. Please tell your friends. Tell your friends. Join our Patreon. Do all the good things. Like, rate, subscribe, comment, etc. We've got massive plans this year in 2024. We've got some very exciting projects on the go. We've got some really cool things up our sleeves. But it is only powered by your ability to do our bidding.
Well said.
But yes, if you would like to do us a New Year's favour as your New Year's resolution, yeah, you could go to our Patreon to support us.
Yeah.
Patreon.com/randomlyhistory.
Yes.
And for the price of a coffee.
Not even a coffee in today's inflationary world.
A
thimble of a singular coffee bean.
A singular coffee bean. You can help support this podcast and make it continue to be whatever this was.
This was the most unhinged.
Actually, don't go on.
This episode was the least hinged. We've got the greasiest hinges this episode.
Yeah.
Anyway, Will, can you please boot up the random number generator and get us the next year?
I can. And as a reminder, we set the random number generator to pick a year between 1000 BCE and 2000 CE. And the next year is
124.
Okay. Rome?
No.
I actually think, I'm looking back
at
the
data. We have not done that before.
No, we haven't done that before. I was going to say, have we done anything in the second century? But we have. We did 177, of course.
This could be quite a tough one to do, actually.
124.
This could be very tough.
There are very few centuries left that we haven't done.
Okay. Well, 124, I look forward to next time.
Yeah.
Whatever we make up, I mean, research for that. Bye.
124, bye. See you then, bye.